Shem Bereshis Bura Lekimis HaShemayim V'Seoretz. In this week's Sadra Bereshis, in the Meir Shiloach here, the Meir Shiloach was assembled, so to speak, edited by the grandson of the Meir Shiloach of Reb Mordechai Yosef Leiner, and Reb Mordechai Yosef told him, you know, he told his grandson, you have to learn Meleches Ksiv, you have to learn writing as a skill, as an art, because you're the one who's going to be writing this Torah. And this Torah is what we've been waiting for since the beginning of time, are these teachings. This is what the Ishbitz said. When the Ari said that in the year 5600, the gates of wisdom are going to be opened, this is the Torah that he was talking about. That's how the Ishbitz thought of the revelation that he was having. He thought of it in those terms. And so this is Bereshis. This is the first of the Torahs that the Radzina transcribed from his notes. And in this Sedra Bereshis, he manages to introduce to us all the great Ishbitz ideas. So first of all, he says, Boro is not an expression of creation, necessarily, but like Labriut, it means health, it means strong, fest. So Boro hu meloshen chizuk. So in the beginning, Boro Elohim, God strengthened everything. What does that mean? Shebrishoino imetz v'chizuk ha'yisoidos sheyuchlu lekabel habrio. That in the beginning, before God said, let there be light, God strengthened the foundations that were then going to be able to hold the light. So that's the meaning of Bereshis Boro. The Rebbeinu Shem, it reinforced the Yesoides, the fundamentals, so that they would be able shiuchli lekabel habriya, to hold it, to sustain it. Like a king who builds a treasure house, so he reinforces, he puts some rebar into the foundation, some extra concrete into the walls, so that they should be able to hold what he's going to be putting in there. So heaven and earth, they're the fundamentals, the foundations of the world. So the Rebbeinu Shlolem Boro, he strengthens them, he's mechazik them, makes them fest. The thing about the Ishbitz is that one of the Yesodis of Ishbitz is that everything in the Torah is happening all the time, and all the commandments, the 613 commandments, as we learned last year, it doesn't matter if it seems obscure and only to apply to the Kohen Gadol, or only to apply to a farmer, or only to apply at a certain time, it's always true. That mitzvah can always be performed. In the same way, the Ishbitz is telling us that Briyas Shemayim Va'oretz, the creation of heaven and earth, is something that's happening all the time, and therefore there's a lesson that we need to have from it, and that's why the Torah is telling us about it. So what is it? He says, heaven and earth, just as heaven and earth are the foundations of the universe, Heim Meramzim B'Nefesh Ha'odom Al Halev V'Hamoyach. So there's a heaven and earth in us, in each of us, and that is the heart and the brain. If a person wants to do the right thing, if a person wants to live his life as the will of God is, he should live it. In order to be whole, in order to be a whole person, you have to live your life a certain way. You can't just decide to do it. You have to prepare. You have to prepare yourself by buttressing, reinforcing the two foundations of the soul, which are the brain and the heart. Hainu, how do you do that? So this is one of the ways that the Ishbitz puts out something that sounds really simple, takes a lot of practice. Hainu limsa ha-seichel v'ha-machashuv shebirosh. To relinquish control, to surrender the mind, the thoughts, v'chol tavis liboy, and all the desires, la Hashem yisborach, to God. You know, we spend a lot of time fighting with ourselves about what we want and whether we can give it to ourselves and whether we should allow it to ourselves. And we spend a lot of time controlling ourselves. And it's a waste of energy. It's a waste of time, and it doesn't ultimately work, because if we have desires and we just keep on frustrating ourselves, then our desires will act around us in a sly way, you know, like in a cunning way. If you go to an AA meeting, one of the things that you'll hear is like, the message is that if you come to AA to learn how to control your drinking, it's not going to work. Because while you're in the meeting, getting what you need to stay sober for a day, the alcoholic part of you is outside in the car park doing push-ups, you know? And it's like on the treadmill at the gym. So you come out feeling, oh, I'm strong, today I'm not going to drink. And then you come face to face with that alcoholic part of you that has also been going to meetings in the car park of other alcoholics, and they've decided that you are going to drink today, right? Because if it comes to a battle of wills, you can't win, because it's cunning and baffling. Our desires are cunning and baffling. So then what is the way? If a person wants to live by the will of God and to do the right thing, so then what's the answer? This is surrender. You have to give it over, limsoir. You have to give over your mind, your thoughts, and your desires. You have to give them to God. And to make God the king of the desires. Right? In English they say, let go and let God. If before a person does something, he prays, God, let this be your will. Then something happens. If it's not, the desire to do it goes. Because if you're talking to yourself all the time, it's not very helpful, because you don't know who's actually doing the talking. So we talk our things through with another person, and we find a person that we can really have no secrets from. And we talk to that person about the will of God. You know, it's like they say, praying is asking God a question, and meditation is listening for an answer. But ultimately we need to have other people around us to tell us the answers that God has for us. So in order to live life properly, whole, to become a whole person, I have to be moist, I have to give over my tavis, my machshavos, I have to, those parts of myself that I think of as mine, those are the parts, my thoughts, my desires, I somehow need to give them over, and not be trying to control them, but to hand them over to God. And here in this first Torah, of Ishbitz and Bereshis, the Radzina also manages to connect the Ishbitz Torah with the Baal Shem Tov, and the most famous Torah of the Baal Shem Tov. If there's one Torah of the Baal Shem Tov that encapsulates the whole Derech of Baal Shem, it's this. Badovar shemachashova shel odom machasheves, shom hu ha'odom kuloi. Inside the thing that you're thinking about, that's where you are. It's not, I am here and I'm thinking about money, you know, in the bank. No. If I'm thinking about money in the bank, then I am in the money in the bank. I'm not here. I'm not, you know, the soul of a person is where that person is thinking. So I'm only here inside myself when I'm here thinking about what's going on inside myself. I'm only whole if my thoughts aren't straying and wandering. To to reach that sort of centeredness, then all the thoughts that I'm having, I can't be running away from them, I can't be rejecting them, I can't be splitting off my personality so that I'm standing by davening but half my thoughts are out, you know, on the internet and half of them are in the siddha, you know, I'm not here, I'm not whole, then there's no shlemus. In order for me to be whole, in order for me to do the ratzon, to do the will of God, I have to, all of me has to be here, and all of me that is here has to be surrendered to God. V'zeh pirush ha-posuk, this is the meaning of the verse in Proverbs. T'no b'ni libcho li, give me, my son, your heart. And then the posuk says, drochai t'tzreno, and then you will guard my path. Not that God is asking two things of us. Give your heart to me and go in my ways. No. The Ishbitzah says, Memeila drochai tetzreno. If you give me your heart, you're going to be walking my will. You're going to be doing what I want. Because once you give your heart to God, which means, how do we give our heart to God? We say, Ribbono Shel, please. And this is a constant prayer. Let my desires be your desire. Please don't plague me with desires that are not your desire. And again, we need another person in our life to mirror, you know, to keep on reminding us that this is what we want, that this is the prayer that we've been praying. And then what happens, then the worship of God becomes the main thing, because that is, you know, the worship of God doesn't mean that I spend my day in yeshiva or in the Beis HaMedrash. The worship of God means that I spend my life doing those things that I've handed over my will and my life and my desires, and I said, God, show me what you want to do, and then I do what I think I need to do. Right? And that is a life spent in worship. And then the mundane world in which I live becomes secondary to the ultimate goal. Al derech moshel, so the Ishbitzah says, I'll give you an example, because I don't need to think, the Ishbitzah says, that when I talk about having a life of worship as the main event, and then the mundane life, the life in the world is being tofel, is being secondary. I don't want you to think that you have to be moos, that you have to be disgusted by the world. That's not the point. He says, derech moshel oshish yesh li ben hogin. So you've got this rich man, right? He's got this fine, upstanding young son. It's a chochem, full of accomplishments, spent 15 years studying in the yeshiva, right? So then the father finds him a shidduch, a beautiful, idle girl, and they're making the chasana, right? Now the father, he's marrying, it's the day of the wedding, he's going around the hall, he's checking, he's spoken to the caterer, is giving him, say, taste this, do you think this is good? Well, this, right? So the father's tasting this food, right? When the father is tasting the food, what is he thinking? It's important. Sure, it's important. It's important that the wedding go off nicely. Sure. It's important there be good food. Sure. Paying $70 a couple. Yeah, of course it's important to be nice. What, people should come and sit down and the food is terrible? No, of course it's important to be a nice meal, be covered, I'm making a chasna, my son, my beautiful daughter-in-law, this is the most amazing event of my life so far, you know, I want it to be beautiful. But ultimately, how important is the taste of the food? It's nothing in the big picture. The big picture is you're making chasen in your son. Does it matter whether the food tastes like this or like this? So, on the one hand, when you look at your life, you know, is it important whether my suit is new this year or whether I wait another? Yeah, of course it's important. It's important to me to look like a mensch when I go into shul, when I walk on the street, when I go in business. Yeah, but ultimately, if I think of my life as this chasana, as this wedding that I have with God, You know, then I keep my eye on the wedding that I have with God and not get bogged down in whether, you know, the mushroom vol-au-vent, or whether it's going to be, you know, like bagels and lox, and like I'm going to get like get into a fight with the caterer about how it tastes, and you know, that means I've lost it. So a way of keeping track in our life about whether we're getting bogged down in minutia or whether we've got our eye on the ball is if we can think that way. If we can know something is important and still not give it too much importance. V'havin. And the Ishvitz says V'havin. And you have to understand what I'm saying. You have to understand. So what is it the Ishvitz wants us to understand? Bereshis bara Elokim, that before you can really approach life, you have to strengthen yourself. How do you strengthen yourself? By encouraging, by giving koyach to those parts of you that are going to be the seat of the soul. What is the seat of the soul? It's the mind and the heart. How do you strengthen those things? And this is the important thing. Not by trying to take control, but by relinquishing control and keep on handing it over to God and praying to be shown the right thing to do. There's a Baal Shem Tov, there's a Torah of the Baal Shem Tov, the Gemara says that if a person says Shma, Shma, the chazan's going, Shma, Shma, the Mishaskinoi say, we tell him to be quiet. Because it sounds like Shtei Rishui is like he's praying to two gods. So the Baal Shem Tov says, maybe he's not praying to two gods, maybe he's got Machshove Zoros, maybe his thoughts are, you know, he starts to say the Shema, and then he realizes, you know, I don't have the right kavona here. I'm thinking about something I saw on the television last night. Right? I'm thinking about, so maybe the person is like, you know, trying to push out those thoughts, those mundane thoughts, and is trying to concentrate on the kavana of the Shema. Why do we tell him to be quiet when he says Shema Shema? So the Baal Shem Tov answers, because if you have a machshava zora, if your thoughts are in strange places, then the chokhmah is not to try and fight them. This is not how you achieve a state of worship, by fighting your thoughts. It's like, all right, you're with me? Okay, I'm bringing you to Daven also. So all those people, you know, if there's something or somebody that I'm lusting for and it, you know, it invades my thoughts, then don't waste time trying to like eject that thought in order to continue with the davening. It's like, okay, with this thought, with this BMW, I'm going to daven here, Rabbeinu Shalom, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, and just to keep on moving. And that's the Baal Shem Tov says, that from the Gemara we see that the Gemara doesn't want us to like be fighting with our thoughts. On the contrary, just hand them over. L'mesor oisam. And then we are given the revelation of what is important and what isn't. And that's the first thing. Vayomer Elokim, this is the second Torah, and God said, Yehi Or, let there be light. So the Medrash Rabba, the great Medrash, there's not many Sephorim in Hebrew that have like the title Rabba. But the Medrash Rabba, it's a great Medrash, right? And it begins with this pasuk, the quote from Rabbi Hoshea. Rabbi Hoshea says, Rabbi Hoshea Rabba, pasuk, the great Rabbi Hoshea opened like this. It says, a pasuk in Mishnah, in Proverbs, Ve'ehyeh etzloi omoin, Ve'ehyeh shashuim yoim yoim, Misacheches lefonov b'chol eis. I was in front of God, Amun. We're going to see that there's some question about how this translates. And if you look in an English JPS Bible or the King James Version of the Bible, everybody has like a different translation of the word Amun. Mostly I think in the Jewish you'll find it, it's a nursling. And by the Goyim, they translate it as a craftsman. But the Torah says, I was Amon, and I was a plaything for a day and a day. And this is where the Midrash gets the idea that God plays with the Torah, with the letters of the Torah for 2,000 years. Because a day of God is 1,000 years. And so Yoim Yoim is 2,000 years. Shashuim is a plaything. So God plays with the permutations of the letters for 2,000 years before the creation of the world. Misachekes lefono b'chal eis. I played before God all the time. So Rav Hoshea says, what does it mean? Omoin. So the first meaning of Omoin is pedagog, which we translate, you know, we understand a pedagog as being a teacher, but that wasn't how it was understood. It was a nursing father. It's the father who carries the child and feeds the child, the baby, with a bottle. That's Omoin pedagog. That's a nursing pedagog. And Hechmad at Omar Kasha Yisoho Oimen es Hayonik, Moshe Rabbeinu, when he complains to God about how the Jews are just giving him a hard time, and he says, Rabbeinu Shalom, you know, you told me to carry these people, you know, and here I am. I didn't give birth to them. I'm not their mother, but here I am walking around carrying them. Kasha Yisoho Oimen es Hayonik, like the nursing father carries the nursing child. So that's one meaning of Oimen. There's another meaning, Omen Mechusa, the covered. Heichmad at Oma, as we say in Echo, Ha'amunim Ale Toila, those who were covered in scarlet. Oh yeah, I lost it. Trying to reconnect here. Hi, I'm back. So we got cut off somehow. Okay, let's continue. We'll continue, okay? Yeah. Omoin mechusa. So the next one is covered, the Amon covered, as we say, it's a verse in Lamentations, those who were covered in scarlet find themselves embracing the dunghills. Alright, so Amon, or Amon, can mean the person who is covered. Then another meaning is Amon Mutzna, the hidden Amon. Hechmad at Oma, as you say, v'hi oimen es hadasa. We talk in the Megillas Esther about Mordechai, and it says, v'hi oimen es hadasa. What does it mean, v'hi oimen? It doesn't mean that he nursed her. It doesn't mean that he covered her. It means that he protected her, that he hid her, so to speak. V'ist Oma, and there are those who say, omen rapso, that the word omen means great. The Tamer, Hatitvi mino omen, there's a pasuk in Nachum, in the third capital, where it says, are you better than omen that dwells there among the rivers, right? And the Targum translates it, Ha'at tova me Alexandria rabsa, are you greater than Alexander the Great, who sits between the rivers? So, the word Amon there means great. Are you better than Amon? It's interesting that the Aramaic translation is trying to get Nochum to be talking about Alexander the Great. Maybe there was another person who had the title Great who lived there in Mesopotamia. And then finally, Rav Hoshea says, Dova Acha, another explanation. Amun, you could read it another way, Uman. An Uman is a craftsman, an artist. HaToyra Oimeres, the Torah says, Ani Hoyisi Kleum Nosa Shalak Kodesh Baruch Hu, I was the craftsman's tool with which God created the world. So the Ishbitzer says a very nice medrash. But why is it important that this be the very first medrash in the whole Torah, the Medrash Rabbah, right? Ve'enim b'zeh. Ki kmo yishi yimotze b'ha'odah me'atchilis ha'viyosoy ad biyosoy letachlis shleimusoy. Just as with a person, if you look at a person's development, there's an evolution from the first, from when a person first comes into existence. Chamisho mine havayis madrigs, there are five levels of being and existence. Birishoino, in the beginning, b'shal zriyas o'avayim, when the father impregnates the mother, right? So then the sperm enters the ovum. At that time, what you get is a reconfiguration of the genetic code, right? You get a new strand of DNA that is made from half the fathers and half the mothers. They explode, you know, the nucleic material in the cell explodes, and you get a recombinant DNA that comes together in a new, never heretofore been in existence version of human DNA, containing the gametes and the genes of both the parents in certain pairs and chromosomes and so on, right? 22, 23. So, at that moment, to all intent and purpose, the person is who they're going to be. I mean, at that moment, within, seconds of the penetration of the ovum by the sperm, there's been like an explosion of this nucleic material, and there's a new strand of DNA that really is who you are. Like, on the last day of a person's life, their DNA is that same DNA that was there at that very first moment. So, how did they change? Well, they went through lots of stages, but essentially, the most profound expression of who a person is their own genetic material, right? That didn't change. It doesn't change. So at the very beginning, the very first moment, the finished person is already there. But behelem gomer, completely hidden. There's no way that somebody looking at this genetic material can say what kind of person this is. There's nothing. Even if you write the human genome and you map this huge strand of DNA, which is this new person who is going to be born in 9 months from now, even if you were able to map that particular genome, you still wouldn't be able to say anything about the person. And yet, many of the character traits that are dominant in that person, besides just being left-handed and redhead, but many of the essential makeup characteristic traits of that person are already there. You know, aggressive, shy, much of the person's endocrine system is already like mapped out there. So, completely hidden. The second stage of existence, once this egg, this zygote, whatever, comes and attaches itself to the wall of the womb of the mother, and then you get a pregnancy that develops, right? And becomes, the mother knows, the father knows, people know, the gynecologist knows, people listen to it with with ultrasound and Doppler, so I mean, even in ancient times, people had ways of listening and knowing, so you could know something about the baby. So that you can know something about the baby. The Havaya Hashlishis, what's the third level of existence? Kishinoilit, when the baby is born. Then, for the first time, you have a whole being that can be known. Publicly, anybody looking, anybody listening, anybody feeling can know something about this child. So then this third level of being is no longer hidden. It's public. In a sense, that makes it complete. Havai Rivius, the fourth level of being, who kishenetak mishtei imoy, when this baby is weaned from the breast, v'yaschelasis pulois, and starts to act autonomously. Havai hachamishis, and then what is the fifth level of being? Kishenoise isha, when this child grows and goes, passes from being a child to being an adult, marries, right, procreates, umaschilasis havai chadosha, and starts the process over again. Lihibonois binin adayad, you know, to get involved in the circle of building something that lasts forever. Ashenetachlis then nivra, for which purpose the child came into being. You know, there's a famous jokey philosophical question, which is not such a joke, which is, you know, are adults created by babies in order to make more babies? Or are babies created by adults in order to make more adults? Right? Like the kind of the chicken and the egg question, on a more profound level, right? The Ishbitz is saying, well, it's clear, you know, that babies are created by adults in order to make more babies, right? In order to create more adults who create more babies. So the imperative to reproduce, that is ultimately the success or failure, you know, of the person, is whether the cycle continues. And that's a way of looking at life that runs contrary to the religious view, which is, no, the purpose of life has to be examined. A person has to look at their own life and see, you know, how have I done? You know, it's not about where I came from, where I'm going to, but where I am and how I fulfill my destiny in myself, right? And the Ishbitz is saying that, strictly speaking, that's a religious view, but that's not how nature looks at things, and that success means that the genes, you know, have reproduced themselves, that the DNA has that's the imperative, you know, spread, reproduce as much and as often as possible to give yourself a, you know, chance of surviving. So the Ishbitz says, "Chein hu hachamisha havayis ha'elu b'briyas ha'olam." Again, when we look at the creation of the world, we find these same five states, and in actual fact, that is what's going on here in Maaseh Bereishis. And as we said before, everything in the Torah is supposed to deal with everybody. It's not just about a history of something that happened or a command that was given to other people. Everything in the Torah is nitzchi, it's permanent, it's infinite, and it's forever. It's for everybody. So these five levels of creation are here in the creation of the world in these first verses of Bereishis. Sheyetze min ha'ein v'ha'elem ha'gomo el ha'gilu v'ha'yesh. For the world, for the universe to come out of this absolute nothingness and the absence of anything into this revealed manifest existence that it has also to pass through these five stages. You know, one of the big paradoxes of science is that, you know, we're taught that one of the controversial ideas of science that sort of ousted religion was the idea of the Big Bang. Right. Not that God, Chalila, says, let there be light, and that's the beginning, but then the Big Bang, right? Everybody talks about the Big Bang. Which is the most absurd statement ever made. Because basically the Big Bang says, first there was nothing, which went bang, and a massive explosion. Right? And when you say to the scientists, but you know, that's a contradiction, you know, because if there was nothing, it couldn't go bang in a big explosion. He says, yeah, but we're only counting from Planck's time after the Big Bang began onwards, and we can figure out everything there is to know about the universe from that mathematical formula of Planck's time after the Big Bang. So science doesn't claim to say anything about the Big Bang itself, but science can only begin Planck's time after the Big Bang began. And that's and so the scientist lets himself off the hook of saying what was there before. He just says it was a singularity. Yeah, so such stuff is science made. Yeah? But he's just given a religious answer, in essence. It's a religious answer because we're told the same thing, right? You can't ask what was before. You can't ask what was above. You can't ask what's behind the creation because that you can't, you know? And then people say, well, you know, that's superstitious, you know? You need to go to science. But science does exactly the same thing. So now the Ishbitzer says like this, Petrile hoyse nikras omein mutzna. In the beginning, the universe was called the concealed, because it was included inside God's essential self. The universe that you and I inhabit now is a thought, so to speak, in the mind of God. And there's no hierarchy. There's no difference between the thinker and the thought and the thinking process. Right? In God, these are not, you know, you and I, we have thoughts, but those thoughts, you know, you can write them down on a paper and it's, you know, it's outside of you. You know, you are not your thought. Your thought is not you. It's a process happening. It's like, but this is not how it is in God, right? And here, the Ishbitzer points to an interesting word, Atzilus, which as we know, Atzilus is the highest level of creation and we talk about an archetypal. We talk about the world of Atzilus, it's the world of archetypes. And what does the word Atzilus actually mean? It comes from the word Etzel, simple Hebrew word which means next to, at the side of. Right? So, Vayetzel min haruach, and Moshe Rabbeinu is commanded to like put on the side a little bit of his spirit, you know, set aside. At this point, at the level of Omoin Mutzna, the concealed Omoin, there is no Atzilus, there is no next to God, right? The creation, the universe, isn't next to, it is part of. V'zois hoysa havai rishona, this is the first existence. U'kishenetz l'mimenu, and then, when God, so to speak, puts it aside, meaning as though, as it were, outside himself, and the world is now no longer in, so to speak, the mind of God, but is now next to, beside God, this is the second level of existence, which is called the covet. And this is like the pregnancy. The universe, saying as though God is pregnant with the universe. This is the mystery of pregnancy. And then the third level, the universe goes, proceeds, it moves further into manifestation, and God becomes the nursing father of the universe. These are the first three sefirot, hanelomim, which are hidden. V'hem kesach chachma bina. These are the three sefirot of kesach chachma bina. V'hamedrash mefarash misata leila. So our medrash, which begins with pedagog, goes to mechusa, then goes to midrash, because it's working its way from bina to chachma to kesach. So therefore it says, b'tchila omen pedagog neged bina, corresponding to bina. V'achekach den omen mechusa sheneged chachma, corresponding to chachma. We have the idea of covered, and then we have Omen Mutzna, the concealed, which is corresponds to the level of the Sephira of Keter, of which we can know nothing. And because it is so hidden, it's not there, it's called Keter. You know, one of the things about Keter, you know, all the Sephirot, you know, we have them in our body, so to speak, you know, starting with the lowest, the feet, and then, you know, we've got Yisod, and then, you know, the others are the torso, Chesed Gevura, the arms and legs, and then Chochma Binah are in the mind, right? Where's Keter? It's not in the body, right? The crown is something that sits outside. It's, if you're wearing a crown, the crown is outside of you. And yet, your head is inside the crown. It's a very, there are many reasons why these images were chosen to represent the Sefirot, right? But essentially, Keter is outside of you, and you can't know Keter, even if you have it on you, because it's not you. Then, so then the world goes into, becomes the great world. It goes into the development, the evolution. That's the equivalent of being weaned from the mother's breast, that the world is then, you know, it's turns away from God and turns outwards. And then we go from Uman, from the nursling, to become the tool, the craftsman's tool. Because then the world becomes manifest, and it's the ultimate manifestation of the world. Then the world itself becomes creative. The world is now the creator, and gives birth to new beings, according to the will of God. And that's why at a wedding, one of the seven brochas is, God, blessed are you who creates man in your image. Why don't we make this brocha at the bris? And the child is in the image of God, right? And we say no. Because even though you, it's true, you're born, you're not finished. But when you become creative and become procreative and proactive in the building of the world, then you are in the image of God. And that is the metaphor of getting married. And this is the meaning of the verse. Says, in the beginning God creates heaven and earth. And the earth is chaos, void and chaos. From the moment of impregnation, from the moment that you get that, the creation of the new DNA, until the pregnancy becomes obvious, that's called toihu. It's void. Once we know that there is a pregnancy, then we call that boihu, we call that chaos, because we know it's there, we just don't know what it is. And the 9 months, they're called the darkness on the face of the abyss. Because then, as the baby develops and grows, then everybody is just interested to know, you know, how this is going to develop. Up to that point, we don't know. And, you know, at the moment of conception, nobody's aware of the conception. Nobody, you know, and the father, mother, not aware. And even as this tiny little, you know, living thing moves through and you know, plants itself into the wall of the womb, we're still not aware, right? But once the pregnancy starts to progress, then we start to wonder. And that's the meaning of voyu. Alkeni kore tohoim, and that's why the abyss is called tohoim. And also the womb is referred to as tohoim. And it contains the word tehoim. Like when Naomi and Ruth come to Beis Lechem, it says, Vatehoim kol ha'ir. And all the world was, all the city was wondering, you know, was astonished, like, what is going on? So the word tahoim is that expression of wondering. And then it says, and the Spirit of God is hovering. When the woman is sitting on the birth stool, as they used to do in ancient times, and, you know, most pregnancies in olden times, you know, they were extremely dangerous. And to the 19th century, you know, when it got really bad, there was a time where women could afford doctors, and then it became even worse because the doctors didn't wash their hands, and it's like pregnancy was deadly. And so the Gemara says that there's a moment there when a woman is giving birth when she's more dead than alive. Charles Korov Levis, Lemisa Yosem Lechaim, she's closer to the other side than she is to this side. Kedisa, as we learn. And that's one of the reasons that she brings a carbon, which is a chatos, a sin offering, because at that moment she's saying, oh, God, and I promise I'm never going to do this again. So that's the Ruach Elikim Rachefes, the Spirit of God is hovering, it's neither here nor there. And then God says, let there be light. When the fifth, so all through the life of a person, we don't know. There's an inion of, there's like a thing of hovering, right? The Spirit of God hovers over us until we become creative ourselves. And then, let there be light. Yihi or. And in this pasuk, the Torah tells us five times the word light, which corresponds to these five levels that Rabbi Hoshea talks about. Chamisha havayis, v'achrein, and finally it says, v'yikru elikim lo'or yoim, and God calls light day. Now is something new. Day means that light has passed from the abstract and become something in time. Haynu shenishlim kol ha'machuvin la'asher bara Hashem yitbarach ha'olam. So now we've achieved the purpose. See, we're kind of running late. Let's move down to the Torah where it says, "Vayitzav Hashem likim al ha'odom lemur." God commanded man, saying, "Mikol eitz hagan ochel teichel, from all the trees of the garden you shall surely eat. U'me'eitz hadas toi v'rav lo'isech memenu, and from the tree of knowledge of good and evil you shall not eat of it." So, it seems on the face of it that Adam and Chava, who ate from the tree of knowledge of good and evil, they disobeyed and they transgressed the prohibition against eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. However, the Ishbitzer says, "Lo'osid," in the future, "Kishi yitukin chet Adam Harishon," when the sin of Adam Harishon is fixed, meaning that the world has gone through the Birurin, as Ishbitzer says many, many times, that there's a process, you know, that when we do something that could be interpreted like this or interpreted like this, then God brings about events in our life through which we have to, you know, prove again and again that the kavana, when we did the original deed, was not as it appeared, but in fact that the kavana of the original deed had God at the center. And therefore, that changes the nature of the original deed. And so, this is why the world takes as long as it takes, because God is doing these birurin. And God is, you know, something happened 10,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago. And God is leading humans through a repetition of that original drama, and with a different resolution. And then through the repetition of the drama and the new resolution, we can now go back and look at that original event in the past and say, you know what happened back then? It's not what we originally thought. There was something else going on. And let's have a look how the Ishbitzer does it here. He says, in the future, when the sin of the eating from the tree of knowledge of good and evil has been fixed, oz yeh tzirf ha-psukim, then the way these verses are assembled will be changed. It will change, and we'll go back to the text and we'll find that, you know, we were reading it wrongly all this time. How will we read it? It will say like this. God says to, he commands, God commands Adam, and he says to him, "Mikol eitz hagan ochel toichel u'me'eitz hadas toi," from every tree of the garden you must eat, and from the tree of knowledge of good, comma. V'achazeh, and then afterwards, the ra, God says to Adam, and evil, lo'isoichu memenu, I don't want you to eat of it. So without actually changing the text, there's a completely new meaning. What we've done is we've moved the comma three words to the left, and so now the text is a completely different text, right? So God says to Adam, I want you to eat from every tree of the garden and from the tree of knowledge of good. And evil, I don't want you to eat of it, right? Hainu hatoiv shebeho elan yoichel. God wants Adam to eat of the good of the tree of knowledge. Rakara lo yoichel, but of the evil, no, I don't want you to eat of the evil in the tree of knowledge, says God. V'Hashem yizborach yivareh, and God is going to unravel history and bring about the birurin that we just described to show through the history of the world that humans have never eaten of the tree of the knowledge of evil but only of the knowledge of good. In fact, the sin that we had, the sin was illusory and imaginary. The sin was that we thought that we had eaten of the tree of knowledge of evil, which is kiklipas hashlum. That's like the husk on the garlic. It's nothing. It just disappears as soon as you put your fingernail under it. It's gone. Right? It's not there. It doesn't really have a real existence. Finally, the Ishbitzer says, "Eselo Ezer Kinegda." God says, "I'm going to make him a helpmeet." So the word is Ezer, like Ezra, meaning a help, and Kinegda, opposite him. Bio Inyan, what's the meaning? Kikenu Rotzen Haboris Baruch Shemoy. This is the will of God. She Yitzmach LoOdam Ezer, that a person's salvation grows Midova Shehu Kinegda. From opposition, from that which is opposite and opposing to him. Kinegdoi. Bahainu, kumay ha-talmud laharaf. So all of our lives is spent trying to avoid conflict, when in actual fact, it's only in the conflict that there is the growth. Like the disciple and the Rebbe. So the Rebbe is trying to teach something, and the disciple, the Talmud, keeps on interrupting and asking and throwing questions, and that is how the Torah is studied. And the Ishbitzer says, that is how life is. There were the two famous protagonists of the Talmud who were constantly throwing questions and challenging each other. The Rabbi Yochanan would ask Rabbi Shlokish 24 questions. And then he would rebut those 24 questions with 24 rebuttals, and they would challenge each other's statements. And so that's how we have this Talmud, this ocean of Talmud, because we learn, when we learn Torah, we learn it in this contrary, oppositionary, almost militant way. We challenge, and we deny, and we fight, and then what happens? There was a time when Rabbi Yochanan had lost Rish Lakish, he wasn't there anymore, and he was depressed, so they sent him this big Talmud. Every time Rabbi Yochanan would say something, Rabbi Loza would say, yeah, that's true, I've got a Mishnah that can prove it. And Rabbi Yochanan said, I need you to agree with me, I need you to tell me I'm right. What was the fun in that? You know, I miss Rish Lakish. He used to shoot me down every time I said something, because that's the pleasure of learning, and in a sense, you know, that's a description of the scientific method. Because you understand what you're being asked, you understand, you give value to the question, you don't dismiss it, you say, oh, this is a good question. So now how am I going to reestablish my thesis? As Yachsik Dvorov, because then a person has to go back and strengthen his own words, Biyoisirayas, with further proofs. The Yetzer Tov Le'Oyer, and this is how things come, you know, this is how we achieve enlightenment, and this is how we get at the truth, you know, not by having people come and agreeing with us, but by having people disagree with us. And in fact, that in life, the Ishbitzer is saying, Eselo Ezer Kinegda, that this is a fact of life. This is how God created humans, that we only progress, we only evolve, you know, by meeting the challenges and by standing our ground, and then by, you know, by examining the things that we say and try and prove them and try and establish the veracity, and that is how we grow. That is really God being helpful. And so in life in general, you know, when we find we meet so much adversity, you know, it's not God being cruel, but that is in fact Ezer Kinegda. God is helping us by opposing us.